This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Are digital music downloading and illegal file sharing killing the record industry as we know it? My guest Steve Knopper concludes his book by saying, "It sure feels like the end is near." Knopper chronicles the rise and fall of the record industry over the past three decades. In his new book, Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age, Knopper covers the music business for Rolling Stone. Steve Knopper, welcome to Fresh Air. Well, your book basically catalogs the mistakes that the record industry has made in the past few decades. So let's start with the CD era. I mean, the record companies had to retool to accommodate the new digital CD technology, and they did. Some of them were reluctant to start over again, but they did it. And you say that they used that as an opportunity to basically retool some of their procedures and rewrite some of the rules in the music world. What were some of the things that they took advantage of to change?
That's a good question. There are a couple of things that were important. One was, I don't know if you remember, it's sort of ancient history, but back in the record, the LP vinyl record era, towards the end, before the CDs were introduced, there was a controversy because the LP prices were stuck at a level of about $8.98 or $9.98. In fact, there was a funny story at the time that made some news when Tom Petty was asked to raise the price of his record at the time. And he protested that by actually putting a sticker within the artwork of the album by saying, "This album cannot be sold for more than $9.98." So, and that made a huge public stink, and the record labels were just completely stuck. So with the CD, the very first thing that they noticed when they finally came around to wanting to put out the CD was they could raise the prices considerably. It started with something like $15.98, and to the great regret of record stores such as Tower Records, every Christmas they would go up $1 a CD, until it was something like $15 to $18, as we well remember in the mid-90s. So that was one thing. And another thing that they did was they were able to go into artist contracts, especially the artists who didn't have a lot of leverage. The Bruce Springsteens of the world were fine. They had leverage. They could pretty much get whatever they wanted in their contract. But the smaller, the mid-sized artists, and certainly catalog artists, artists who'd been around for a while, they could go back and say, "We've got this new technology. We're going to charge you a new technology deduction from your royalty payment." And there were several different fees like this. And the smart artist attorneys argued and argued and argued, and the ones who didn't notice, who didn't see the fine print, just sort of got run over. And so that was, as several people in the industry told me, and certainly several artist attorneys, that was a not insignificant reason why the record labels were able to go from a profitable model of selling LPs to an incredibly booming explosion for almost 15 years of selling CDs.
And do you think in the long run that bubble backfired and helped undermine the record company's best interests?
Yes, I do think so. If you ask somebody in 1987 or 1991, the year of Michael Jackson and Nirvana, is this going to last forever? If you asked anybody at a major label that question, they would say, "Of course, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing. We're not even going to think about changing." And they all had their departments where they would tinker with new technology and mess with digital music, but it was really nothing serious. And they just wanted to go on with that same model that they'd had forever. And when Napster came along, which I'm sure we'll get to, it kind of bit them in the rear end. They weren't prepared, and they certainly weren't prepared to change the model.
Before Napster came along, there was the development of DATs, digital audio tape, and it had some of the advantages of CDs because it was digital. There was no tape hiss, and unlike like reel-to-reel or cassette machines, you had a digital display. You could fast forward from track to track, so it had some real conveniences. But the music industry was really worried about this technology. What were they worried about?
Well, they were worried about one word: record. Basically, the people in the record industry, the executives from the major record labels said, "You know, DAT allows us to make allows people who buy music to make pristine copies, and then they can make pristine copies of the copies endlessly." So it was different from the cassette. You could make a copy or a mixtape from a cassette, but the copy wasn't very good. And certainly, I don't know, Terry, if you've ever tried to copy a cassette twice or make a second or third copy, it doesn't come out very well.
You keep doubling the amount of hiss. Maybe not doubling, but you keep adding more,
exactly,
more hiss and noise each time you make
static.
A copy.
Correct.
So the record industry lobbied for legislation to prevent people from recording CDs onto DAT.
Correct.
And that legislation, the Audio Home Recording Act of 1992, had this huge loophole in it. And the loophole had to do with the computer industry. Would you explain the loophole and how the record industry made a mistake?
Yes. What happened was during the negotiations for the Audio Home Recording Act, the congressional negotiations, the record industry was pushing to basically regulate the DAT. So either it couldn't be copied, an individual DAT couldn't be copied more than one or two times, or they would get paid a royalty payment. There were a lot of conditions that they had. And what happened was the computer company, they had a lot of rules that were being put into this act. And the computer companies, this was back in the early 90s, said, Apple, Microsoft, and so forth, said, you know what? This is not going to be very good for us because people should be allowed to copy their CD-ROMs. They should be allowed to have as many copies as they want of their information. So from what I found out in my reporting was that the lawyers for the computer companies basically, as they called it, threw themselves on the railroad tracks. And they said, you're doing this over our dead body. And so there was a huge negotiation. And it wasn't like the record industry just sort of fell over and said, okay, no problem. There was a battle over this, but in the end, they realized that they were not going to get their legislation passed unless they made this concession to the computer companies. They didn't like it, but they had to do it. They probably could have done something differently. But certainly 3 or 4 years later, computers started to come out with, as you know, CD burners. And CD burning, ripping and burning, was just as much of a problem for the record industry as Napster and online file sharing ultimately became.
Some of the problems that hit the record industry, in addition to things like Napster and iTunes, was radio promotion. There was a big payola scandal that killed a lot of the record companies' techniques for promoting music on the radio. MTV stopped playing music videos for the most part, so that was no longer around as an avenue for promoting music. And then something that seemed like a real boon to the record industry, selling CDs in the big box stores like Walmart and Target, ended up kind of backfiring too. So let's talk about the big box stores. You say that the record industry made some real big mistakes there. How did records end up being sold in big box stores in the first place?
Well, what happened was in the mid-80s, these big box stores, particularly Best Buy, which was kind of the first company to really sell records in that kind of a major electronics / department store, record companies said to themselves, we're selling a lot of records. This is great. If we go through Tower and we go through the indie record stores in everybody's town, we're doing a lot of business. How could we do more? How can we go from selling, $3 or $4 million on every major release, every big blockbuster, to $10 million or $11 million? Well, we need better sales, better distribution. So they started to make deals with big box stores like Best Buy and Walmart. And certainly, I don't think anybody in my book is criticizing them for doing that. That's just capitalism. But what happened was Best Buy and Walmart wanted to basically reduce the prices of the CDs. And if they did that, they started to undercut the competitors like the Towers and the mom and pop record stores of the world. And, in the mid-80s to the mid-90s, during the CD boom that I talk about, you had to have CDs in a Walmart, but they would sell CDs for what they call a loss leader. They would deep discount them. So people would come into the store to buy the new Jay-Z album and then go, hey, I need a $1,500 computer too. And that was sort of the big box business model. The record labels didn't agree with that business model. They just wanted to sell the music. And so what happened was the big boxes, even though they didn't have the same interests as the music business, became much more powerful and had much more clout. And they started to be able to dictate terms. And then certainly in the post-Napster era, when CDs started to become less important and less profitable and less cool, the big boxes started to cut back on them. And once that started to happen, and that is currently happening now, you can't even look at the label's old-fashioned CD model as something very viable in the future.
Let's move into the Napster era. And just describe Napster for somebody, for anybody who doesn't know what it was.
Sure, absolutely. Napster was basically a computer program. It was software that was created by a young guy, a 19-year-old college freshman named Sean Fanning. And it basically allowed you, it was software that you could download from the internet. And you could download it and put it up on your screen and be able to share for free just about any song ever made with an endless list of tens, hundreds of millions of people around the world. This was obviously a huge threat to somebody whose business model involves selling compact discs for $15 to $18. And in addition, it had the disadvantage of being illegal. It was infringing on the copyrights of the music to be able to pirate them, to be able to give them away for free.
Well, the record industry responded with a copyright infringement lawsuit in December of 1999. And about 3 years later, Napster went under. So in the short run, the record industry won. They killed Napster. But in the long run, there's been lots of other file sharing systems that have emerged, and that the threat to the record industry is still out there. What other options did the record industry have in dealing with Napster? Do you think that the record industry actually missed opportunities?
Yes. The record labels had a chance to make a deal with Napster, and instead they saw Napster purely as an illegal tool for piracy, which it was, really. I'm not letting Napster off the hook on that. But it also was the future of the business, which I think almost anyone can see today in 2020 hindsight. And the people who were, there were people in the record industry, people who were working at major record labels, who were telling their superiors, the top executives, that very thing at the time. They saw it. And it wasn't like the record labels didn't have anybody who was an expert on technology and, oh no, they got run over by technology. They kind of weren't listening to their important underlings in this case, some really important people who were high-tech experts. And so I suggest in the book that you had a service where people were getting music for free, of course, and at its peak, it was something like 26 million users on there at any one time. And this was an incredibly powerful service. This was a service for people who loved music. Yes, they were getting it for free, and that's why a lot of people liked it. But that wasn't even necessarily the best part of the service. I mean, it seems kind of quaint to think about now, but in 1999, it was such a revelation to think, wow, I don't have to get in my car, drive to the Best Buy, pay $18 for the Britney Spears song or the Britney Spears album or the Chumbawamba album that has the one song I like. I can actually just sit at home and cherry pick it and get that one song, and it's incredibly more convenient for me. I love music, you know, and so I think that what the record industry should have done was made a deal with Napster and use that service for marketing purposes, to sell other merchandise, to build fan pages, to use the marketing data. There were so many different things. And many people I interviewed agreed with this point. Some disagreed too. But I certainly think that there was lost opportunity there. And one other point I'd like to make about that, a large amount of that blame goes to the record industry, but a large amount also goes to Napster. In addition to Sean Fanning, who was this nice, young, kind of easygoing college student guy who created Napster and ran it, Napster was also run by his uncle, an older guy named John Fanning. And by all accounts, John Fanning was not a very conciliatory guy. And he would go around saying, we're going to take down the industry with free music and that sort of thing. And so the record industry wound up dealing with people like him and other people who were venture capitalists helping up Napster, who had much more of that rebel spirit. So in the record label's defense, it was difficult to make a deal with Napster at the time. But nonetheless, it was crucial to their future, to their survival, I believe.
The record industry made a few attempts to solve its download and copyright problems by trying to create their own secure technology that would prevent you from downloading or sharing music that hadn't been legally accessed with copyright respected, you know, with royalties respected. You say that some of those attempts were pretty lame. Give us an example of one of the music industry's attempts to come up with its own secure technology that you think was pretty misguided.
There are a few things. And one, you know, the most egregious example of that, which basically kind of took down the whole idea of doing that, was something called Rootkit. And that was, I believe, 2005. And it was something that the major record label, Sony BMG, chose to do. They put on this really hardcore copyright protection technology on CDs that they sold. And what happened was people would rip this Neil Diamond CD onto their computer, and not only would they get the songs, but they would get a nice virus. The Rootkit, it's complicated, but it basically has the potential to allow hackers to get into your system and take it over and freeze up the system and create mischief, basically. And this was a huge debacle for Sony BMG. It didn't help that one of their top executives kind of came out and was blasé about the whole thing and said, who cares? He backtracked on that later. But the damage was done, and basically this sort of was the peak of digital rights management, of that whole lock idea.
Well, another mistake you think the record industry made was in suing music fans, suing college students who were file-sharing recordings. Now, granted, the students were not following copyright laws. There were no royalties being paid here. What they were doing was illegal. Why do you think it was a mistake to sue them?
Well, for a number of reasons, but I think that the PR reason, first and foremost. I grant that the record industry, at the time they started the lawsuits, which was September 2003, was in a tough spot. I mean, millions upon millions of people were stealing music online. And, okay, they sued Napster and they won. They sued Kazaa and LimeWire and some others and they won. And yet they still had a problem. So they went after the users. And the users were their own customers. And what happened was that those customers and all the other people who were familiar with the lawsuits just got really upset with the record industry. They were already kind of upset with Napster. But you had people like the 13-year-old girl in New York, who was not well off, Brianna Lahara, who got a lot of press at the time. And you had old people, old ladies and old men who were doing this, whose kids did this and they didn't know it. And suddenly there was this parade of regular folk who were having media hype and being paraded in headlines, who were suddenly having to settle for $3,000 per lawsuit. And this went on, obviously, for the last 5 years. And I think I wouldn't have said it was a big mistake had it actually had some impact on the file sharing numbers. But there are services such as BigChampagne.com which track the peer-to-peer file sharing numbers, and these lawsuits seem to have negligible impact. If anything, the numbers of people pirating music went the other direction. And frankly, I think that the RIAA lawsuits served to just anger people against the record industry. And in fact, just recently, in December, the RIAA announced that they would no longer be doing this lawsuit campaign after more than 35,000 lawsuits. They're still continuing the cases of people that they sued before, but they're not going to do it anymore. And the sources that I've talked to in the record industry are basically saying, good riddance. Even people within record companies are saying that. And I think that's true.
Let's look at the iPod and iTunes model. Apple seems to have worked out a workable arrangement with the record companies over access to their material and copyright. Would you describe what the deal is between Apple and the record industry for access and payments?
Sure. Just generally speaking, what happens is the record labels own all the music. You're Warner and you own the entire Neil Young catalog, let's say. So you can do anything you want with it. You can license it to a television commercial. You can license it to a movie for a soundtrack. You can put it out on a CD. You own that music. So basically, you can put it, you can sell it wherever you want. You could sell it at Tower Records via CD, or you could sell it digitally through the iTunes store. And so they, basically the labels just entered into a deal with Steve Jobs and Apple where they would sell their music just like any other retail store, just like Walmart, just like Tower, just like Best Buy. And the deal was basically that it was a very favorable deal, really, if you look into the brass tacks for the record labels, because they made something like 70 cents per song sold on the 99-cent download. And Apple, being the retailer, took the cut of something like 22 cents. So on the face of it, it seems like, wow, this is a really skewed deal for the record labels. And I'm sure that's one of the big negotiating points that Steve Jobs used. But what the record labels failed to realize at the time, I think, or maybe didn't think would be as big of a deal, was that Steve Jobs' business model is not to sell necessarily 99-cent tracks on the iTunes store. And even though he sold more than a billion of them, and it's 22 cents each, that's a lot of money, his job is to sell iPods. And those make tons of money. The margins are much higher. It's very similar to the loss leader idea of Best Buy selling a 999 CD to get someone to come in and buy a refrigerator. The labels finally realized, you know what? This is not that good of a deal for us.
And that's the way it was until early January when they reached a new agreement. Why did the agreement about 99 cents a song change?
Well, the record labels were never happy with the 99 cent per song deal. They sort of felt like Steve Jobs had railroaded them into that deal, which is a little bit disingenuous. I mean, we're talking about some really good professional deal makers here, some of the best in the world. But they felt that they'd been kind of shoved into this bad business deal where they could only charge one price for their product. And so they'd been pushing Steve Jobs for since iTunes came out, since 2003, to change this. And up until this point, Steve Jobs has been pretty obstinate about it. He actually accused the labels in response of being greedy about 4 years ago. But he capitulated just recently, and he agreed to this new scheme of three different prices, 69 and 99 cents and $1.29. And it makes more sense. I think it's fair, and I think it's good for the labels, although probably won't save them in the long run, but still good for them.
What do the three grades of prices represent, and why is that supposed to be good for the record industry?
Well, the three grades represent 69 cents for older catalog stuff, you know, the songs that had come out years and years ago, $1.29 for hot hits that are out now. And 99 cents somewhere in the middle. Frankly, they, from my reporting, they haven't really said which songs would be attached to which price yet. But it's good for the record labels because it's always good when you can charge a little bit more for something when you're a business, or at least have the freedom to charge a little bit more for something. And it doesn't strike me as an unreasonable change. I mean, I'm somebody who likes to buy songs at iTunes. Is it really going to kill me to pay an extra 30 cents for a really big hit? I think it'll be good. You know, I think it seems reasonable to me. And plus, I'm enticed by the idea that older stuff that I like, is going to be 69 cents, and that might make me buy more. I'm not trying to just sort of give the labels a pass here, but it certainly seems like a reasonable pricing scheme for a consumer to me.
Now, the copying restrictions for songs on iTunes also changed in this new agreement. Describe that change.
Yes, absolutely. It's a little complicated, but the gist of it is that when Steve Jobs and the labels made their agreement back in 2002, the labels insisted back then on some form of copy protection. So, in other words, 50 people couldn't line up on their dorm hall at college with hard disks in their hand and just take all the iTunes downloads from the one computer. You know, you had to have some limit. I think the limit is something like 5 or 6 computers is the limit that you can put an iTunes song download on. So that went on for years, but that had a weird side effect, and which Steve Jobs exploited fairly masterfully. And the side effect was that when you buy a song from the iTunes music store for 99 cents, you can pretty much only play it on iTunes, and therefore you can only sync it on one type of digital music player, which is an iPod. And of course, there's ways to get around that if you're a high-tech hacker. Most people aren't. So if you own, you or I own a Microsoft Zune or an Arcos or some kind of fancy cell phone that's not an iPod or an iPhone, it's very difficult for us to play that song that we bought from iTunes. What just happened in early January was that Steve Jobs, or rather the labels, agreed, since they don't really care anymore, things have changed for them, they agreed to get rid of the copy protection completely. And Steve Jobs was okay with that. And so now, if you or I own our Microsoft Zune, we can sync that, or we will be able to sync that with the iTunes Music Store. They're different, you know, they talk about interoperability. Different players work with iTunes. Different players work with each other. Suddenly, sort of the walls have come down, and it creates a market where consumers are less frustrated. And again, I think this is another good change. And these two changes are interesting because they're the first changes that have really come from the labels as far as digital music that really are just 100% positive. They're all good. And I think that this may point to a future of the labels, although I don't think that these changes in and of themselves are going to save the labels anytime soon.
You know, by going through Apple and relying on digital downloads, the record industry also misses out on a lot of stops along the way that were profit-making, like the record manufacturing plants. They made a lot of money out of those.
Right. Years ago, you know, during the CD boom certainly and earlier, one of the major ways that major record labels such as Warner or Sony or BMG made a lot of money was because they owned their own plants. They owned the plants that and the whole distribution mechanism. You know, there's a whole chain of events for a record to go from you know, Oasis makes a record to the studio, and then it winds up at your mom and pop record store down the street. You need to have trucks and warehouses and crates and boxes and people in every link on that chain who are hired to basically cart them around. And the record labels made a series of business decisions, a series of purchases throughout the 60s and 70s, where they wound up owning that entire empire. And for years, they had these very powerful distribution companies. Just to name one, Warner owned this company called WEA, W-E-A, which stood for Warner Elektra Atlantic. And they just made money hand over fist throughout, and especially during the CD boom, and especially during, you know, the teen pop era, which I write about when Britney and the Backstreet Boys were selling incredible numbers of albums. But what happened was, when Napster and the internet came along, that whole thing just became redundant. It became extinct. It wasn't necessary to have these crates or these trucks or warehouses. Suddenly, you can just make a click on your computer and the music comes right to you. You don't need that middleman infrastructure, which is what made a ton of money for the labels. And so, sure enough, I mean, that was part of the reason, a big part, I think, that the labels got so defensive about this threat that online music and Napster and other things was giving to them. Because they saw that this whole old-fashioned business model was going to come tumbling down eventually. And sure enough, in the earlier part of this decade, most of the major labels, not all of them, but most of them actually sold these distribution companies and would outsource the trucks and warehouses and so forth. So other entities made them all the money off of them, and they didn't have to do that anymore. And that, I think that is also a not insignificant reason that record labels are in as much trouble as they are now.
iTunes is legit. iTunes licenses the music from the record industry. But there are still plenty of peer-to-peer file-sharing networks that don't pay any royalties and aren't officially sanctioned from the music industry. So now that the music industry has stopped its policy of trying to sue individuals who are flaunting the copyright laws, where is the music industry now in terms of dealing with file sharing networks that aren't dealing with copyright?
Let me answer that two quick ways. The first is the music industry is not done suing everybody. But nonetheless, I think that what we've seen just recently is that the record labels are shifting their strategy of suing people. And now they want to work with the internet service providers, the Comcasts of the world, and say, hey, when we notice someone's downloading tons and tons of stuff, tons and tons of illegal music, and we identify that person, we want to contact you and have you contact your customer and tell them, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. And through that process, we'll get fewer and fewer people sharing files. You know, that has its problems too, but I think it's a little bit better than this purely punitive sort of, we're going to sue the crap out of everybody and your only way to get out of this is a $3,000 lawsuit settlement.
So is there anything that you see out there in addition to iTunes that you think is a possible model for the digital era of music distribution?
You know, I interview a lot of record executives for my job as a reporter at Rolling Stone. And the thing I hear over and over again from record executives is it's not just one thing. We used to be trapped in this model of we're going to sell CDs and that's it. Now it's everything. You've got social networking services like Facebook. You've got subscription services like Rhapsody. You've got LPs are coming back. They're making a very unexpected comeback among hipster college students. So we're going to sell those to you. There's ringtones and ringbacks, and there's an album these days comes out. It's not just an album. It's a collection of ringtones, and it's a collection it comes out in sometimes dozens of different versions. And I think that the record labels feel like if we can collect all these things under one umbrella, then suddenly we've got a new business model. I actually think that there's something to that. I do think it's a little bit too little too late, though.
What about musicians? I mean, something I worry about is how are musicians supposed to make a living now? You know, you got a lot of people, illegally downloading and file sharing music. If the record companies aren't making a lot of money by selling 99-cent singles on iTunes, then probably the artists aren't either. So what model do you see for artists making a living playing their music?
Well, I have a short answer and a long answer, a longer answer. The short answer is concerts. Basically, we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years, the balance of power in the music industry has completely shifted from selling CDs and these major record labels, which were once all powerful, to concert companies, and more specifically, managers such as Irving Azoff, who manages the Eagles and Jimmy Buffett. And these people know how to make tons and tons of money off of concert sales now. I mean, you've probably noticed that concert ticket prices are very, very high. I think Madonna's ticket on her recent tour topped out at something like $370. This is, you can sell an expensive item like that with a high profit margin. And so what we're seeing now is that artists are starting to give away their music for free. Let me give you a quick example. I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and although he and his record label, Columbia, have never been hugely, I would say, forward-thinking on the digital front, but they started putting out free MP3s on their website and on Amazon of songs from Springsteen's upcoming album, which is due out in later this month, later in January. And why are they doing that? Well, you say, okay, number one, they're trying to use it as a marketing technique like Radiohead did to sell copies of the album. Okay, that's number one. But even more to the point, that's right around the same time of the Super Bowl, and Springsteen performs at the halftime show of the Super Bowl, and he's going to launch his tour after the Super Bowl, presumably charging, you know, $100 or $200 for tickets. And the MP3 is going to basically be a promotional device, just as singles were in the old days, to help him sell tickets for this tour. It definitely worked for Tom Petty last year, and it's going to work for Springsteen this year, I think, next year.
Okay, Springsteen is already a big star. It doesn't take much to to get people to go to a Springsteen concert. But say you and I are starting a band, far-fetched.
Yes.
But say you and I are starting a band that no one's ever heard of. How are we supposed to get known? Without the kind of old record company, you know, promotion infrastructure, without like the radio play and the record store promotion and all that stuff.
Well, let me use my own band. I actually joined a band. It's called the Propane Daisies. For a small band like us, or small bands in general, there are more promotional outlets than ever. I mean, in the old days, you basically could sign to a major label, or you could try to get in the listings of your local newspaper, and that was pretty much it. Now, of course, MySpace, YouTube, all these different things. I just did an interview with a guy from TuneCore this morning who helps you get your songs for a very cheap price onto iTunes and Amazon and all these other downloading systems. It is easier than ever. And once you, you know, there are a lot of success stories. There's OK Go, the rock band from Chicago, who did this crazy, goofy treadmill video and put it on YouTube. And, you know, it got however many millions of hits. And suddenly these guys are getting calls from obscure countries in Europe, in Eastern Europe, saying, can you come play some gigs here? We'll pay all your expenses. So this does happen. Suddenly bands are liberated. It used to be you needed a record label to get you onto the radio, to get you into the retail stores, to get you into the major magazines. That's still true to an extent, but now you can bypass that whole system by using Facebook and MySpace and YouTube and TuneCore and all these other things that I'm talking about. I think it's kind of a fascinating new world, and I think that bands are going to take advantage of it, and we may not see the 15 million selling artist anymore. We'll still see probably the 2 or 3 million selling artist. And, you know, maybe that whole bling era is gone for good. But it certainly opens a lot of doors for smaller artists to get a foothold and to be successful, I think. And I think that's positive.
So you don't think you need healthy record labels to have healthy music and for America to have a vital music life?
Not necessarily. I do think that record labels will always have their place. I think that there will always be a couple of major labels, maybe a Universal or a Sony BMG, maybe another one or two. And they will do that traditional thing of discovering the next Eminem, taking him or her to that big, huge blockbuster cover of Rolling Stone kind of level. And, you know, that process is good. We all love celebrities, you know. We all love watching Britney and all that kind of stuff. I'm no exception. So I think that's good that exists. But I think that a lot of those deals that the major labels did were unfair. And I think that the fact that the mold is broken, I think is positive, yes.
Steve Knopper, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Steve Knopper is the author of the new book, Appetite for Self-Destruction. This is the track Bruce Springsteen posted as a free download for 1 week in December. The CD will be released later this month. Jeb Loy Nichols has recorded a half dozen albums since the late 90s, and before that, fronted the band The Fellow Travelers. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Nichols' new album, called Parish Bar, strives to be casual and tossed off, but it comes together as one of his more adventurous musical experiments.
I ain't gonna marry in the fall. No, I ain't gonna marry in the spring. I fell in love with a pretty little girl, and she wears another's ring. Oh, I am just a country boy. Money have I none, oh, but I got silver in the stars and gold in the morning sun.
Jeb Loy Nichols may sing in that song that he's just a country boy, but the music surrounding that sentiment is designed to contradict him to his advantage. Nichols has made his cult by recording mixtures of country, jazz, and soul music, often acoustic, much of it low-key to the point of enervating. But this new collection, recorded, Nichols says, in his spare time, mostly at home, between other projects over the past couple of years, is his most inviting album yet. It seems both offhand and sincerely curious in its musical explorations.
Last night there was a mobile here. I was down at a dance in a full room, and the DJ was playing big tunes, and every room in the place was just boom, 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 boom. And records were jumping, and the place was thumping.
That song is called Country Music Disco 45, and Nichols says it's inspired by a real-life event. At a dance with a DJ playing a lot of disco, the mix was suddenly enhanced by a Charlie Rich record. Charlie Rich was a big country star primarily in the 70s with ballads like Behind Closed Doors. In a similar way, Jeb Loy Nichols' song and its lyric emphasizes how much he likes to mix things up. Crossing genres is essential to him to keep his music vital. That certainly comes across on this song, I'm Blue, I'm Lonesome Too, a song credited to one James B. Smith, but just as often ascribed to a collaboration between Bill Monroe and Hank Williams. Nichols, however, radically rearranges this bluegrass number.
The lonesome side of a train going by makes me want to stop and cry. I recall the day it took you away. I'm blue, I'm lonesome too.
As the new beats in that recording prove, Nichols has a knack for rearranging songs without turning them into stunts. The sentiment about being blue and lonesome comes across as effectively as it did in its 50-year-old country context, even if Nichols has nothing on Bill Monroe's band when it comes to vocals and instrumentation. In fact, Nichols tends to murmur words in a snoozy manner, a conversational croon that owes a lot, perhaps too much, to Mose Allison and Leon Redbone. For every bit of earned intimacy, there's a hint of Too Cool by Half. It's a tone he drops on this song, a cover of Tom T. Hall's country song about alcohol called Satan's Helper, that benefits from Nichols' straightforward singing.
When I was just in my teens, nothing much that I would fear. Then a best friend got me thirsting for whiskey, wine, and beer. I grew a quiet and sinister rage, saw the world through blood-red eyes. Faces and places fade away, floating nameless through my life. Inside that wondrous bottle, at absolutely no extra cost, lives a demon called deception, Satan's helper of the lost. That demon of the bottle takes a man to set it free, chasing shadows in the darkness, and now they're after me.
If his self-conscious eclecticism is what prevents Nichols from getting more than a toehold into the mainstream, it's also what keeps him interesting. Essentially a music bohemian, drifting through styles in the same way he drifted through and left boho-friendly places like Manhattan and Austin, Texas, Nichols is like a modern-day beat poet. He rides rhythms wherever they take him. As the album Parish Bar proves, sometimes pleasant aimlessness is its own reward.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Parish Bar by Jeb Loy Nichols.